Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Well, certainly I think that there is no doubt that what occurred, came about because of racism, white supremacy. You have a young adult black, white male saying that he wanted to kill black people, and saying black men rape white women, and that black people were taking over the country. I don't know whether he was making reference to the fact that the country is supposed to now be run by the first black president. And so, without a doubt, this falls within our understanding of racism, white supremacy, certainly. But as I have watched the programs on CNN and other channels, I really found myself, because the people at the church and many other people commenting, political figures and television figures, were talking about how wonderful it was that black and white people were together in the church, and the black and white people were singing We Shall Overcome and holding hands and swaying back and forth. And I found myself feeling nauseated, if I really speak the truth, and disgusted. And I just thought that after Ferguson, you have black and white people marching together, and then you have another event. You see, and then you have the events in Baltimore, and you have black people and white people marching together, and everybody saying how wonderful that people are getting together. And I jotted a note down, and Monday, this is Thursday, and by Monday, everybody will be back again playing their part in the system of racism, white supremacy, either as people who classify themselves as white or the people that the whites classify as the black people who are the victims of racism, white supremacy. And I know that people hearing me might say, oh, how can she say that? Isn't it wonderful? The people are all holding hands, like Martin Luther King wanted them to do. You see, but the very fact that we go from event to event, and I'm certain that because this young man not only killed black people, but, I mean, it's just disgusting that there were six black women and three black men who were killed, and an 87-year-old black woman was killed. And I said, when are we as black people going to have the level of self-respect and courage to really come out of the slave role, Slave, obey your master. Turn the other cheek. Make certain you turn the other cheek and you'll get your reward in heaven. And that's a slave role. We haven't maybe thought about it in those terms. But, for example, people never, and there, you know, there'll be black people coming forward and saying they forgive the shooter. That they forgive and they think this is the thing to do. I mean, that's the cycle of events as far as we are concerned. And I said, no, this is highly incorrect.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, April 12th, 2016. So I have been told. That was Dr. Francis Cress Welsing the day after the shooting at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, back in June of 2015. Always, I think, profound to hear Dr. Welsing's perspective on things, and particularly hearing what she just said, as I, again, just within the first 24 hours of Dylan Storm Roof's act of white terrorism, political assassination. Again, make sure we get that in for what happened with State Senator Reverend Clementa Pinckney. The program today, we should have Professor Vernon Burton with us on the broadcast. I gave him a ring just a minute or so before 8 p.m., our confirmed broadcast time, and I went straight to his voicemail. They did have a tacky act of racism on the campus of Clemson. Today he's a professor down at Clemson in South Carolina, and he had said that he might have to be involved with dealing with all that. It was not anything as severe as Mr. Dylan Storm Roof. It was someone apparently hung some bananas on a sign that was promoting something related to African-American Student Center or courses down at Clemson. They hung some bananas from this banner, and it was being correctly investigated and discussed, perceived, thought of as an act of white terrorism, and a tacky act at that. I did not exactly think it was the sort of thing that would call for DEFCON 4 and calling in of the National Reserve and what have you just for, I think it was three bananas, but at any rate, we will give him a ring again, see if he will be joining us for the broadcast. Looking forward to discussing his book, which is all about the history of racism, white supremacy in South Carolina. And my man, Pitchfork Ben Tillman, The Threat of Negro Domination Hangs Over Us Like the Sword of Damocles. We'll give him a ring again right now and see if he is with us for Give the Ring, folks.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system. 217649-0608 is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Greetings, Professor Burton. This would be Gus calling second time. It's about 10 minutes after 8 p.m. Eastern. Our confirmed broadcast time, 8 p.m. this evening. Second time giving you a ring. I will try once again. I'll give you about 10 minutes or so and give another ring. I've checked my email and I didn't see anything from you with regards to the program if anything came up. So hoping you will be honoring your agreement. We'll try again. Thank you, sir. All righty. I think some of the folks who were listening via that called in may not have heard. My apologies. I think we had the sound off there. It should be on and rolling. Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade. As I said, our guest for the evening, Professor Vernon Burton, white man suspected a race soldier. He is a professor at Clemson University down in South Carolina. We were supposed to have him on the program to discuss his book, which deals with the history of racism, white supremacy in South Carolina. And specifically, it's really just dealing with one area, Edgefield, South Carolina, which is infamous for me and I would think for any of the folks who pitched in, listened when we did our book study session on Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy, Stephen Kantrowitz, back last summer, right following the massacre at Mother Emanuel AME Church. Would know Edgefield, that is former South Carolina governor, former United States senator, University of Clemson co-founder, and Winthrop University co-founder, staunch, proud, unashamed white supremacist, one-eyed pitchfork Ben Ryan Tillman. That is his stomping ground, Edgefield, and notorious for violence, that particular area, even white people fighting and dueling and shooting and killing other white people. But that's Vernon Burton. That's what his book specifically deals with, racism, white supremacy, and white culture in Edgefield, South Carolina, both before the Civil War, afterwards, during Reconstruction. Obviously, Ben Tillman is a pretty major figure in the book. He also examines black people, what they were doing before the Civil War, afterwards, how all of that impacted family life, religious life. It's pretty pretty interesting read. As I said, the folks that heard me, I'm going to give him about 10 minutes and give him another ring. This would be one, in my view, it'd be a pretty major act of racism because we have been communicating for some weeks now on trying to get him on the program. Thank folks who were listening. He was supposed to be with us last Thursday, and we rescheduled. He had some family events that were going on and said that this week would be easier for him to be on the broadcast. I said, no problem. That'll give me more time to go through your work, do my research and what have you, read his book and everything. And we communicated this morning when we confirmed for the broadcast time. He gave me his contact information so I could ring him for the program. And he did share that they had the incident at Clemson with the bananas that I touched on. For the folks who called in who didn't hear, they have a banner at Clemson University. I posted it on Facebook. That was relating to some of the African-American resources on the campus of Clemson. And apparently some tacky whites hung a set of bananas from the banner, and it was accurately perceived as a tacky act of racism. And they investigated. Apparently some of the students who did this stepped forward. He had said this morning, and this is early, this is like it was still morning my time. There's a three-hour time difference between us. So it was sometime before 12 noon Eastern. And he said that he might be called in to manage some of the optics around all of this. He's a professor of history and African-American studies down at Clemson. Studies, talks about, teaches about issues dealing with race. And I wrote him back and said, you know, if you can let me know ASAP, if you're thinking this is something where we're going to have to reschedule, where you're not going to be able to honor your agreement and come speak with us this evening. He wrote me back twice after that and said that this evening would not be a problem, gave me his number, and I'm looking at my email right now, and I have not received any further communiques from him. So this could just be an act of racism on his part. And another white person being tacky and not honoring his agreement, but we'll see. We'll give him 10 minutes to show up. Again, I've said consistently this is the sort of thing that really, I mean, there are many things that bother me in the system of racism, white supremacy, but I value my time. People frequently do not have much value or regard for the time and energy of black people, and that's everybody, white people and victims of racism. And I know I've had for years people disparage my efforts here in the context of white supremacy and saying that, you know, this is some Mickey Mouse operation and they don't really do anything and he doesn't really invest any time doing his research or preparing for programs. That is simply not the case. The vast majority of the programs, particularly when we have authors, there are quite a few hours that go into preparing for just that individual program, because I do make an effort to read the book. If we have an author that is coming on the program, I'm not just going to be lazy about it, white person or victim of racism. I'm not just going to be lazy about it and flip through or get the cliff notes or read a couple reviews online and just go from there. I'm actually going to sit down and read the book and highlight and pick out things that I want to discuss in the book. regardless of the length of the book or the quality of the book. I'm going to sit down and read it cover to cover, and in this case, reading his book as well as some of his other essays, because he'd given some speeches in South Carolina about all of these events, being at Clemson and pretty close to Charleston, talking about what happened last summer with Dylan Storm Roof. And the controversy in South Carolina about the removal of the Confederate flag, the removal of the statues to Ben Tillman and Tillman Hall. It's actually on the campuses of Winthrop University and Clemson, since he was a co-founder of both institutions. He had been involved in some of these conversations and giving speeches about all of this. And so he sent me some of his more recent talks that he's done regarding these issues. So checking those out as well. Did quite a bit of prep work that I could have been doing other things. Black mental health, just doing some replenishing and rejuvenation to make sure that I'm in better spirits moving forward to continue with other work, preparing for other programs that we have coming up this week. We should be back, I believe, Thursday with having attempted black parents on the program and talking about how their parenting styles have changed as they've gotten less confused about racism, white supremacy, what their parenting was like prior to having that information, and then how things have changed. It's not all good. It's not all bad. But I thought pertinent information, particularly, I know we have a good segment of listeners who are attempted mothers, attempted fathers, thought they would appreciate that information and can share it with their own experiences and suggestions. But that should be going down Thursday. Friday, we have the book club last segment on Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World, compensatory call-in this Saturday, normal time. And then Sunday, we should have our Global Sunday talk on racism. So we have a pretty full slate for this week. As I said, I could have been doing other things with my time and energy than slogging through his material, which I've been reading for a couple days now. But we'll see if he honors his commitment or even sends a word of explanation as to what the deal is if he did get called. I will make sure I get in. I was going to begin our conversation this evening with Professor Burton with this. The whole banana thing, when I saw it, as I said, in my view, if some racists did this, some white students or anybody, a white faculty member, just regular white civilian, even if they're not affiliated with the institution, in my view, it would be an act of racism, knowing deliberate act of racism, that whites have a long legacy of associating black people with animals, in particular monkeys. I mentioned Planet of the Apes on our last broadcast. However, that is not the sort of thing, and I was even thinking if I was a black student, because they were saying that they had protests and that sort of thing, I'm not even sure how much time and energy I'd be willing to invest in, you know, trying to call attention to that. I would, you know, put it on social media to let people know that it happened. And incorporate that in any of my discussions, classes, that sort of thing, that white people are not ignorant about racism, that they just continue with the same stale, passed down. Really, these are racist heirlooms in terms of concepts and ways of thinking about and associations, racist white supremacist associations that whites make about black people. This is nothing new, but it would be difficult for me on the campus of Clemson when you've got statues and buildings named after Ben Tillman, Strom Thurmond, and other proud, staunch white supremacists. It would be difficult for me to make much of a brouhaha about bananas when this is likely racist incident number, I don't know, 5,302 for this week. More to come before the day is out. It would be difficult for me to invest too much time and energy in three bananas. As I said, I would make note of it, no doubt, act of racism. I would make note of it. Whomever did this, I would definitely be interested in what the punishment is going to be, hopefully something other than sensitivity training. But I mean, you know, there are untold numbers, untold incidents of racism, white supremacy, not just on the campus of Clemson, but worldwide each day. That's pretty low on my register in terms of things that would bother me or upset me. I would be way more disgusted about Professor Vernon Burton reneging on his agreement to speak with us this evening than about some produce hung from a sign. That being said, one other comment I'll make sure I get in before I make an effort to give him a ring one more time. Just in relation to the program that we had this past Sunday, we had a white guest on Sunday as well, John Patash, suspected race soldier. And people rightly called in, several people called in and gave their views or commentary about him not being forthright, didn't think he was being completely honest in some of his responses to the callers, particularly about quote-unquote Jewish people conspiring to practice racism, white supremacy within the entertainment industry. And just one thing I wanted to make clear, it would be not just an anomaly. I think it would be likely impossible to have a white person not practice racism, being deceptive in some manner in withholding completely accurate information from non-white people. I can't think of a single person who I would say, hey, this is the one white person. This is the one exception to the rule where this white person, every time, every question that you ask, they give all the detail, even some of the details that you didn't necessarily ask about, all pertinent information, names, dates, everything. Nothing is withheld. That, for me, I do not expect that from any white person. I always think it's correct, as callers did, to point that out. What I would say, though, anytime I'm talking to a white person, I make a judgment about how much constructive information they have to offer. And I will definitely say that there are white people that have been on this program who have a lot more constructive information to offer. Does that mean that they're not racist? No way. But it does mean that they have a little bit more constructive information that I think would benefit us to pick out what it is that they're sharing. Mr. Patash's books, not that I'm encouraging folks to purchase any of the material, those books, I think, have a lot of constructive material that I think a lot of people, if you checked out the material, you would learn quite a bit about racism, white supremacy, names, dates, patterns. He touches on a lot of things that we talk about. The practice of racism is going to be there as well in terms of not using the most accurate terms to describe things at times. But still, I think that's going to be there. And at times when we have a white person, and I think they have more constructive information to offer, I don't focus as much attention on picking out, you know, oh, I think you could be practicing racism here and there. I just really try and get as much of the constructive information out as possible. And there have been some other times where that's happened on the program. I think Dr. Martin Kevorkian might be one where I thought he had a pretty solid amount of constructive material to offer. Mr. Vaknin, he's in Macedonia, the white male who spoke with us a few years back about narcissism. Same thing. We've had a few, not many. Not many. Mr. Burton would not be in that group, even if he had showed up on time, as we had planned. Not in that group. So, yeah, feel free. I even have my own questions to swing away from his book and just general things in terms of him being a white person and, in my view, practicing racism, white supremacy. But just make sure I get that in for clarification. I think I've shared that a few times on the program before about being judicious about when I make an effort to question a white person specifically about how they are practicing racism, white supremacy. A lot of times it will come down to, what am I trying to get from this white person? Sometimes I'm trying to get other information that I think is constructive, that I think would benefit us to hear. Folks have a different view. That's great. And again, always great. In my view, it is always correct. That's something that we don't do enough of, and that's victims of racism calling out whites, asking questions, and just being aware and alert for when even a white person, when they do have accurate information, when they are still practicing racism, because that just doesn't happen often enough, and we should never be gloating and happy and delighted. Oh, this is the greatest white person since John Brown, just because they, you know, shared a few tidbits about what they and their clan are doing to terrorize us. And I hope didn't come across Sunday or even today. I think John Patash is a cool white man, not racist, not the case at all. Just his books, in my view, do have constructive value. Read them both. I've read them both. All right. Given enough time, I will give Professor Burton one more call, see if he's with us to share. I'm still looking at my email and haven't really seen any updates from him as to what the deal is, if he's going to be with us, if something came up. We'll give him one more ring and see what's going on here. Forgive the ring on the phone.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system. 2-1.
Alrighty. No answer once again, so I will just assume that Mr. Burton will not be joining us this evening and is likely deliberately practicing racism, white supremacy. As I said, I'm looking at my email, and I still see nothing, no updates, no nothing. Tackiness to be expected from racist man, racist woman. And again, that's the sort of thing I do not take from racists or victims of racism, because that's happened before when people cancel on the day of the program or just out and out renege and there's nothing, there's no explanation, no, oh man, the dog spilled my coffee and, you know, it hurt, really shook me up, I'm traumatized, I'm going to need a day or two to recover. When it's nothing, I mean, whoo, I take that as the height of just total disregard for your time and energy. That's the sort of thing, even if I did do it, I would say the same thing that Gus, total disregard for whomever's time and energy. If I did that to someone where I had agreed and confirmed the day of, not just we agreed a month ago or a year ago that we were going to do such and such at this date and this time. I mean, literally hours ago, we agreed, confirmed, date, time, all of that, having a discussion, and then nothing. You can't take with all the gadgets and technology, particularly that white people have. And this white man, he does cyber technology at Clemson. He does not just have expertise on racism and South Carolina history. He also seems to have quite a bit of expertise about computer technology. To not have 60 seconds to just say, oh, hey, niggers, I'm not going to be able to do your program. As I said, you know, my dog ate my homework. I got other things to do. Peace out. 60 seconds. Not that big a deal. Oh, okay. No problem. Recalibrate use of time. Nothing. Super tacky, major act of racism, white supremacy. Even though I would not, this book is in no way, shape, form comparable to any of the other books that we've done, in my view, that have constructive information on racism, white supremacy. It does have a few tidbits here and there that I thought were worth sharing, that I was looking forward to sharing with listeners, getting some of his thoughts. The only one I will get in to share. He had details about the long legacy before, way before we get to Dylan Storm Roof. Again, for people who were with us when we read Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy, where he talks about the history of racism and attacking black political elected political officials in South Carolina, and even just regular black citizens who were trying to vote post-Civil War, how they were attacked by Ben Tillman and his ilk, terrorized, and then whites like Ben Tillman bragged about these acts, and Mr. Tillman even rode this all the way to the governor's office in South Carolina. But he has this one passage here where he talks about the history of white terrorism in South Carolina, and I don't think he uses the term terrorism in the book to describe all of this. That's worth bringing up as well. But he writes, "Violent opposition to some black churches occurred. From the northwest corner of Edgefield, the superintendent of Dorn Gold Mine wrote of a group of white white terrorists who call themselves regulators. In 1872, last Sunday, an attack was made by them on a small building where a Sunday school was held. No one arrested because of fear. The regulators heard of an African-American prayer meeting being held with white property owners' permission and threatened, 'There have been meetings of this kind in our community, and we find them to terminate politically and not spiritually. Regulators believed it was all right to worship in the daytime, but not at night at all. We cannot and will not tolerate such in neighboring communities. Despite opposition and without much white local support, Edgefield African American persevered. Edgefield Afro-American churches persevered." Legacy of violence, terrorism, white terrorism targeting black people, black churches specifically in South Carolina. And I was correct. He did use the term terrorist there, but the term terrorism does not appear anywhere in this book, which I didn't think it did. Just double checking as I went through. That was something else that I was going to bring up with him as well. And just putting this on a continuum, that was kind of the way that I wanted to structure going through his book, which is titled, I guess, just for general information, if folks are so inclined. The title of the book, In My Father's House Are Many Mansions, and it, again, is dealing with the history of racism, white supremacy in South Carolina, and specific to the city Edgefield in South Carolina. But I wanted to put this on the continuum of what it means to be white. I don't think he gives that. At sometimes he is pretty explicit about that, but putting it on the continuum of it's not just Ben Tillman. It's J. Marion Sims, who we'll hear about next week when we start for the book club. Harriet Washington, Medical Apartheid, when we start her book. Marion J. Sims, prominent character in the book. Another South Carolina legend, white terrorist who tortured, mauled, mutilated black female bodies in the name of science and experimentation. He's regarded today as the father of gynecology, and he has statues not just in South Carolina, but in New York and Alabama. It's him. It's Strom Thurmond. It's Dylan Storm Roof. It is a long legacy, if we just want to be exclusive to South Carolina, of what it means to be white. And even he does have information that's not in his book, but it's in one of the speeches that he just gave, where Tillman Hall on the campus of Clemson, it was not always named Tillman Hall, even though he is a co-founder of the university. It was Old Main Hall. That was the name of the campus, but racists, out of spite in the 1940s, got upset. They felt that they were being forced to revise the system of racism, white supremacy, and to maintain the system in a manner that they did not agree with. They were going to have to make adjustments and give allocate more resources to Negroes than what they wanted. So out of spite, they changed the name of the hall to Tillman Hall. And this was in the 1940s. And there were lots of instances of this happening throughout this part of the world, where you had high schools. We talked about one before down in Florida, I believe, that was named Nathaniel Bedford Forrest High School. This is named after a person who is regarded as a founder of the Ku Klux Klan. They changed the name of the high school during the same time period, angry because we don't like what we're being told to do with our Negroes, and we have to bring them to school with us. So out of racist spite, we're going to change the name of the school to a Klansman. They did this sort of thing repeatedly throughout this area of the world. In fact, even the flag, Senator Clyburn, who's a black male, Congressman, I'm sorry, he's not a senator, he's a congressman. Congressman James Clyburn, black male in South Carolina, he has even pointed out that when they talk about the Confederate flag in South Carolina, and this is our tradition, this is our heritage, and specifically the Confederate flag that was flying at the state capitol, that that flag was not always there, that it was placed there to commemorate the centennial of the Civil War. It was only supposed to be there for 1 year. Again, patterns. Whites were so angry about what was happening and upset with their Negroes that they just decided to leave it up until last summer, Bree Newsom, all that, and they took it down. But pointing these types of things out, in my view, just make it very clear. You cannot be ignorant about racism. He does have a few points in his book where he makes that pretty clear, in my opinion, just talking about white people in unison, in mass. We're in total agreement about white domination over black people. It didn't matter if you were a poor white person, rich white person, if you owned slaves prior to the Civil War, if you didn't own slaves after the Civil War, whatever. If you were white, child, female, male, you understood and were in total agreement. We're supposed to be dominating Negroes. And if you didn't agree, or even seemed like you had a slightly different manner about how white supremacy should be maintained, you're going to get in trouble with other white people. He had examples of that in the book as well. That's the point I always try to make sure that I emphasize when we talk with white guests. As I said, yeah, a little bit disgruntled. I was looking to get my favorite Ben Tillman quotes in. The threat of Negro domination hangs over us like the sword of Damocles. That is my favorite quote number two. And then favorite quote number one: if you scratch the white man too deep, you will find the same savage whose ancestry used to roam wild in Britain. Number one favorite quote. And I think that right there, in my view, one of the most accurate statements about the white race, what it means to be white, that you will ever hear. The only amendment, this does not just apply to white males. This is white females, white males, white children, anyone who identifies themselves as white, classified as white. This is what you should expect. All manner of tackiness, barbarism, savagery, terrorism. That's what it means to be white, and they revel and glorify in this. That's why these figures have statues everywhere. Strom Thurmond, Ben Tillman. You can't turn in South Carolina and pretty much all the other states, but you can't even make a turn in any of these areas without bumping into a worshipped relic of the religion of white supremacy and dominating, terrorizing, mutilating black people. They're everywhere in South Carolina, not just the Confederate flag. With that, super disgruntled. Just kind of looking over my notes, anything else that I was going to bring up Zachary Hammond as well. Folks remember the white teen. He was shot and killed by police in South Carolina last year. He was with his druggy friends. They would make these folks are so smart. They were some of his white friends. They were going to make a drug transaction, and they ended up calling an enforcement officer and thinking that this was the person they were supposed to be making the drug transaction with. The police arrive on the scene, and Mr. Hammond, he doesn't obey. I didn't hear a chorus of white people coming out and said, "Hey, follow orders. If you just listen to police, we're going to have these incidents." I didn't hear a chorus of that. The police arrived. This young thug, Zachary Hammond, he didn't follow orders. Police officers approached him in the parking lot of some fast food restaurant. He didn't obey. He attempted to continue driving. He was parked. He started the car, attempted to drive away. The officer felt threatened, as though he was using the vehicle as a weapon to hit him or to move him aside, and just generally not complying with an enforcement official. And he shot into the vehicle and killed Mr. Hammond. But I was bringing that point up because there was so much commentary, and they even got some of our previous guests and black people in and saying, "Oh, man, this is terrible. There's no hue and cry. Where's all the attention for this poor young white lad who's been shot and killed by police? Where are the marches? Where's the looting? Where's the rioting? Where's Al Sharpton?" They did all of this, which I thought was just another tacky illustration. And again, them practicing racism. I felt at some points like they were chastising, admonishing black people, like, "Why aren't you all up in arms about this?" And then a greater narrative of, you know, why in general? Why isn't the mainstream media sources and what have you, why aren't they focusing on this case in the same manner that they have Michael Brown, Eric Garner, pick your case, Sandra Bland? I wanted to ask him about that as well. The family, they recently got $1 million settlement. They've continued to pout and gripe about not getting adequate attention for this case. I was going to get his thoughts on that. I've talked about that case quite a few times since last summer or so. When it was all brought up, they have the dash cam video you can check out as well, so you can see how everything unfolded and how this suspected racist was shot and killed. Good riddance. That would be my concluding comment on it all. Good riddance, one less racist you have to deal with. But just even with that incident, I did see a lot of black people, unfortunately, who were talking about this and saying, "Oh, this is terrible. Oh, I can't believe they did this. Oh, man, this is so, you know, such a sad incident, and police terrorism running wild." That was not how I processed it at all. These young thugs, they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. Druggies, everything that they said about Michael Brown should apply here. Strong-armed thugs out not obeying authority, not doing what they're supposed to do. Hey, that's what you get. That's what happens when you're not a law-abiding citizen trying to do something constructive with your life. This is what can happen. Everything that they have said for the past year, even about Eric Garner, he had those Lucy's out selling cigarettes. Oh, well, this is what happens when you don't obey and pay attention to peace officers. And these are law officers that are out protecting us. You're supposed to do what you're supposed to do. Isn't that what they said about Sandra Bland? Isn't that what they said about Renisha McBride? Oh, well, good riddance. One less racist you have to deal with. All right. With that, again, slightly bummed our guest not being here. I will check in. Caller from Florida. I saw a couple of folks who had hands up. Probably will not be hanging out for the evening. Again, I can do other things with my time and energy, but I'll check in with the folks who had a hand up if y'all had any comments that you wanted to get in before we wrap things up. Caller in Florida, did you have anything you wanted to get in, sir?
What was your take on Mrs. Clinton's comedy, quote unquote, attempt?
Just another example of tackiness. For people who don't know, she was with Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York. This was this past weekend. And they're getting ready for the big New York primary that's supposed to be coming up, I guess, in a few days or weeks or whenever it is. And she said that, I guess, Mayor de Blasio, and there would be a cowbell ring as well, but I guess Mayor de Blasio has only recently announced his endorsement of Hillary Clinton. And so they referenced this in their quote-unquote comedy skit this past weekend. In saying that, I think she said something to the effect of, it took you long enough, talking to Mr. de Blasio, in reference to him taking so long to endorse her. And he said that he was on CP time, meaning colored people time, and this was supposed to be funny. They had a black person on stage, I believe one of the actors for the play Hamilton, that's been a big to-do they've been talking about. I think they did a portion of this at the Grammys this past year. And I think Ms. Clinton, after he said this, she said something to the effect of sensitive politician time. Oh, man, you know, we got to get ourselves together. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. We can't be making, you know, comments like that. And they said afterwards that this was a joke. This was a planned joke, that everybody was in on it. They had already scripted this out that they were going to say, and they were just doing this to be funny. We've had a different white guest on the program back in 2012. Where she talks, she has a whole section of the book that talks about this specifically with racist jokes, and how racists at times, they will do things, they will say things under the guise of this is a joke, so that they can say something racist, but then they're not supposed to be thought of, branded, certainly no consequences for practicing racism, because this is under the rubric of a joke. We were all just kidding, and we set this up in advance. And they were so slick and refined about it, they pulled a victim in and make it, oh, see, he was in on it too. We all just did this for giggles. And they got Mayor de Blasio, as I said, cowbell, because he's married to a black female. So, of course, you know, Mr. de Blasio would not be practicing racism. That was his whole campaign for running for mayor, was to deal with racism in New York and income inequality. And now he's supposed to be dealing with gentrification in New York. And he made all this big to-do about stop and frisk in New York and cutting that down. He's married to a black female. He's got, quote-unquote, multiracial children, mixed-race children, and had them front and center for his full campaign. So, of course, nobody here is being racist, which I say is total hogwash. I think racist, particularly more refined racists, they will set up situations like that where they have a context where they can make a racist white supremacist performance. But we victims are supposed to be fooled about this. I think that this is all good. And I would say, particularly putting it in context, that this was just 2 days after super mega hypocrite and super, in my view, the suspect shouldn't even be there, but just for professional codified purposes, suspected race soldier, monstrous race soldier Bill Clinton, his commentary and shaking his finger at these Black Lives Matter protesters, to then have them come out and be so cavalier with all of this, just really stands out in my opinion. And I think, I guess my final comment, I think all of that appeals to whites. I know people were talking about Bill Clinton's comments from last week and saying that this might hurt her. I don't think so. I think for white people, they appreciate that sort of thing. It certainly does not bother them seeing a white person practice racism. I'm sure many white people love it. Like, we need more of that. Put them niggers in their place. I'm tired of hearing these loudmouth niggers talking about Black Lives Matter or whatever else. That's right. Get on them, Bill. Right on. I'm going to go vote for her now. I could see that being the effect. And just continuing, I don't see this having a problem with white people. And I would even be surprised if there was some sort of mass exodus of black people who support Hillary Clinton taking these comments and saying that they're no longer going to support her. I have a hard time seeing that having that sort of impact. I could be incorrect. But, yeah, I thought it was pretty tacky. Again, pretty low on my scale of racism, white supremacy. Yes, an act of racism. But that, too, I would find way less bothersome than our guest reneging tonight on his agreement, and certainly way, 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 way astronomically less harmful than what she and her husband have done to black people in their various capacities, Secretary of State, President, United States Senator, maybe even another term in the White House. That would be my commentary, if that makes sense.
Yes, what's most dangerous about Mrs. Clinton, along with a lot of other white women, is that they can infiltrate into all aspects of our lives, including in our beds in a lot of cases, with very little or no opposition at all. Just come right on in, and very little suspicion by non-white black people, especially as far as stopping her at the door, questioning her, what are you coming here for? What do you expect?
Q&A session is over. Q&A session started.
Sorry about that. Pressed the wrong button. Retired firefighter, you were saying, sir? I think it muted his line accidentally. I'm sorry about that. That was my fault. I hit the wrong button. I had a switchboard issue I was trying to correct. Your volume was muted when you said stopping them at the door, and then if you remember where you left off at?
Yeah, well, that's what we should be doing, stopping them at the door, questioning them or why they're coming into my home, into my church, into my meeting. But she is so crafty. So crafty at her ability to twist, manipulate. If there's a book on it, she's one of the authors, that's for sure, yeah, as far as they're concerned. I've seen enough of her during this long period of time of this, in my opinion, low level of what the word politics actually means. And it still has a long way to go. And she's right at the front of it. And she just, like I said, originally said that she's just an example of how white females can infiltrate into all aspects of non-white people. That's my last thought. Thank you.
Absolutely. And Mayor de Blasio, because he would be, in my view, equally culpable for this tacky act of white supremacy. And I would say the same thing. He got elected. I think a lot of black people at least were. I think a lot of black people voted for him in New York. We talked about this. I think he was elected, began his term in 2013. I think a lot of black people was the same thing. He's married to a black female. He's got these, you know, beautiful mulatto children. This is the greatest, you know, white man since John Brown. I think the exact same thing. A lot of the same lack of suspicion, the same lack of understanding of what it means to be white with Hillary Clinton, Mayor de Blasio, Bill Clinton, lots of them. This seems to be the case, unfortunately. And Bernie Sanders. Make sure I double down so people do not get confused. I have the exact same opinion of Bernie Sanders because I have seen an equal, if not a great, in fact, I would even amend that. I have seen a greater lack of suspicion for Bernie Sanders, in my opinion. I have seen a lot of people, even very prominent people, talking about how they believe that Hillary Clinton and her husband have practiced racism, talking about the crime bill and various things that they have said and done throughout the last 2 decades or so, and their treatment of President Obama and some of the other things. I have not heard very much suspicion at all of Bernie Sanders. This is the greatest white man in the history of ever. And if we just had 20 more Bernie Sanders, we could knock this thing out, you know, right now. This is the best non-racist candidate we've ever had ever. And that is not my opinion of Bernie Sanders either. I'm all of the white people. I marched with Dr. King and I was in SNCC and I've kissed a black person. They're on the racist suspect list too. I've seen nothing from this from this candidate from Vermont to suggest that he also is not strong race soldier and doing more of the same, just a bit more sophisticated in his message, and will make comments from time to time about racism, white supremacy. But I don't see really any level of suspicion there either. I see tons of black people who think he's great. And I've even seen black people who have gotten upset when people called out or offered scrutiny, criticism of Bernie Sanders in ways that he, as a white man, could be practicing racism. I've seen where a number of black people got upset, like, how dare you? Who do you think you are to criticize this white man? Which just, again, shows the level of victimization and us not understanding what it means to be white, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas in New York, did you have a commentary? I see some of the other folks who called in. We'll get you all as well.
Hey, guys, I can definitely agree with you.
Your volume is very low, sir. It's kind of hard to hear you.
I definitely agree with you, and the firefighter, what you're saying. And I just to put Mr. de Blasio in context, I mean, if Hillary and Bill walked in the door and de Blasio...
Are you still with us, Thomas, in New York? Not here. Oh, okay.
You know, so he's definitely race suspect number one. I think probably the most dangerous politician in America when you look at his family. I mean, the way he could get in and out of the nips and crevices of things. And that joke was tacky. It didn't surprise me. I mean, it sounded like it was written by your man, Bill Mayer. I was going to ask the guest about growing up in 96, South Carolina, the city of 96. I was doing some reading on that, and I just was interested. I had some questions on him regarding that. And other than that, I'll mute my line. Thank you for taking my call.
For sure. The female caller in New York, did you have commentary you wanted to share? Female caller in New York, did you have commentary that you wanted to share? Or were you just listening, ma'am? Let's see, it looks like. Got it. I might just be messing up with the switchboard. We'll see if we can get it correct.
May I be heard?
Okay, we got you.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi. Yes. Thanks for taking my call. No, that incident with Bill de Blasio and the actor from Hamilton and Hillary Clinton happened, I think, I saw it on Sunday. So I think it happened on Saturday, and today is Tuesday. So in my opinion, and I could be wrong about this, it's as if they are they held that for a moment. I don't know. I find it very hard to believe that, you know, a lot of people got really upset and called the media and had an opinion on it. I highly doubt that. And the reason why is because Bill de Blasio is under a lot of scrutiny these days for his campaign finances, where he's got his money from. There's also a police scandal going down in the lieutenant ranks. Four of his lieutenants were fired. Also, there was a former chief, a black male, I forget his name, but he resigned like a year ago, shortly after Bill de Blasio won the election. And it's coming to light now that he had some nefarious dealings with some Hasidic people, and he took a lot of money under the table, so-called, and this is why he had to resign. So Bill de Blasio is under scrutiny for that. So I suspect that there will be some more things that are coming up because, you know, the police, this man had to build a fence around Gracie Mansion. You know, he's been the target from his own police force for quite some time since he's been in office. So, yeah, that was just my opinion about that. And this whole play Hamilton, I recently spoke to a very confused black female over the weekend who loves this play. Not that I'm like very clear about a lot of things, because I guess that's the reason why I had to ask her about it. Apparently, Hamilton was some sort of founder of the Treasury, and this play Hamilton is supposed to be a musical about him, and white people seem to think that this man who wrote this play Hamilton is some sort of genius. Tickets for that play currently are $1,200. So, this thing is a big deal, and they cast this black male in there. There was a huge, big kerfuffle about how he was cast, and I think there was another person who was playing the role at one point who was found dead somewhere. So this play Hamilton kind of, to me, exemplifies the entire system of white supremacy where monetary gain is concerned and how they feel that their money is God. So I think that's why there's a big deal about this play Hamilton, and that's all I had. I mute my line.
Right on. Yeah, I'm not sure I know it was in the New York Times today where they were talking about it in terms of when it broke. I think it has been, I think it's been gaining attention over the last couple days. I think over the weekend people were still talking about Bill Clinton's, or I guess people are still talking about what he said last week in Pennsylvania to the Black Lives Matter protesters. But I think the Hillary Clinton thing, it did happen this weekend, and it has, I think, only recently began to get more and more attention where people have been talking about that and scrutinizing it. Before I think Roz and M1 dialed in as well, I also wanted to add, I was going to bring up, because I do think this is significant, that in South Carolina they pushed back the court proceedings for Dylan Storm Roof, white terrorist, because they are still, I guess, contemplating if they're going to pursue the death penalty. I think that's significant as well. That's something that I talked about last year where I gave my thoughts where they win either way. I could see them making a white sacrifice out of Dylan Storm Roof, and then he becomes a martyr to a certain section of whites, members of the white race. I could see them doing, because they have been talking a lot about abolishing the death penalty. I could see them making some sort of decision where this ends up getting abolished, so he is not eligible to receive the death penalty. I could see a lot of different ways, permutations in terms of how they orchestrate this, where the system of white supremacy still wins. I even am reminded when James Byrd Jr., the black male that was lynched in Texas back in the 1990s, 1998, I believe, by his white friend. It was a gang of three whites, but one of them was his friend. They gave him a ride home and drug him to death behind a pickup truck. But in that case, two of those white terrorists did get the death penalty. And they had a lot of black people, Dick Gregory being one, that went out and protested and said, you know, he shouldn't get the death penalty. Let's just have him get, you know, life in prison. I could see that sort of thing happening again, where you have, because there have been a lot of black people, rightfully so, saying that we should do away with the death penalty, abolish it. It's racist, disproportionately impacts black people. Absolutely. I could see that happening as well, where you get a lot of victims of racism who say he shouldn't get the death penalty, even his family, since there was so much, some of the family members of the victims, since there was so much we forgive and that sort of thing, the Christian rhetoric. Our guest, he has that in the book as well, how the religion of white supremacy, he has some really, in my view, significant portions of the book where he talks about how whites calibrated, spoke openly about the significance, the importance of white Jesus and using the religion of white supremacy to strengthen their control over Negroes. Was looking forward to getting that in as well. Roz, if you're with us, if you had commentary you wanted to share, sir.
Yes, greetings to you guys and to all the callers. Yeah, it was brief. I was listening to you speak about Mayor de Blasio or Hillary Clinton, and it just made me think. That discussion we had was a prime example of how miscegenated children or children of miscegenated unions play a buffer, simply because if you're married to a black person or if you have so-called mixed-race children, essentially, it almost completely exonerates you from being called a racist in the white world. So essentially, they get to be racist, have all the fun they want, and then go back and basically dominate their non-white children once they get home. And they're looked at as, I call it the proverbial white race card. That's their version of the race card. Have yourself a mixed relationship, have yourself some mixed race children, and you have carte blanche to be a racist and not be called out as a racist. And also, I wanted to ask you if you saw the article that I sent you about the CRISPR genetic thing with the transhumanism, they're calling it, where they're trying to make genes where people can change, like, actual colors, so-called race colors, like chameleons do. Did you get to see that?
Yes, I did, sir. That was a great find. I meant to reply to that message. We had been talking about this for people who maybe missed out or don't know what CRISPR is. The gene editing technology, we brought it up several times. I talked about this with Dr. Welsing before her transition. There's a white woman, her name escapes me at the moment, but I'll get it in a moment. She's one of the people that's credited with coming up with this technology to do this really sophisticated editing of human genes. And she commented, this is in the New York Times, where she said that she grew up in Hawaii around all these non-white people, and she grew up feeling like a freak being around these people, and that this motivated her to be very bookish and into science. And then over the arc, the evolution of her life, this is what she ends up doing, starting out feeling like a freak, genetic recessive, melanin deficient in comparison to non-white people. And the article ended in the New York Times, and they were talking about this last year. The article ended with her saying that she still feels like sees herself through the lens of this freak in Hawaii. That's still how she thinks and sees herself. And they had a picture of her. She has really, really, really pale skin, blue eyes, I believe. Just prototype. If you need an image, melanin deficient individual, it would be her. Anyway, we have been talking about this. Dr. Welsing, I sent her that article, talked about literally weeks before her transition. I spoke to her on the phone about this, and we were talking about this, like what are they going to do with this technology? How is it going to be used? I could see it going a myriad of ways. The article that he's talking about where they were saying using this technology to change the pigmentation of people's colors, almost, I mean, it's so... if you're familiar with X-Men, like the character Mystique, where you can change your skin to different colors, that was almost the way that they were talking about this in the article, in addition to all these other things to change your genetic material so that you can be smarter, faster, taller, haircut, all the, I mean, just a variety of things. Just allow your mind to run wild. I'm unsure. Certainly feel free to share your thoughts, because it was a wonderful find, the importance of reading and just trying to get information. I doubt it would be difficult for me to see whites. They have invested so much in the worship of the phenotypical features that are associated with quote unquote white people, the white race. I have a hard time imagining large numbers of white people wanting to change their skin complexion to be dark on a permanent basis. I could see them playing around with this sort of thing, but I couldn't see that being like a permanent thing for whites. Although I could definitely like the other things that they were talking about in terms of you can be stronger, you can be faster, you can all the other things that they can edit, you can be smarter. I could certainly see that, and I could see it being some sort of editing so that they are not as vulnerable to sunlight, since they have so many deficiencies being associated with their near state of albinism. I could certainly see them trying to correct some of the deficiencies that they have as a result of that. But I have a difficult time. I would have to see it. I would have to see, like, on a long-term basis, large numbers of white people wanting to alter and have significantly darker skin to look like a non-white person, because they have invested so much in those phenotypically white features, if that makes sense. What were your thoughts about the piece? And again, outstanding find, sir.
Oh, thank you. I was going to say, I agree like 10,000,000% with everything you just said. And I thought that if white people did utilize it to change their skin tone, it wouldn't be really dark. I believe it would be kind of like a tan. So they would basically look tan all the time. I also thought about the reverse. When Dr. Welsing used to talk about if she had a magic pill, one of them would be one that can turn a black person white. I wonder what black people would do, because they would then have the opportunity, I guess, to change skin color as far as becoming quote unquote melanin deficient. Like, and you know, I really thought about it. And I said, this white lady is really like she is a poster child for everything that Dr. Welsing has talked about her entire life. Everything about the way she functions, even especially with that article, just that ability to do those sorts of things and play with color. And again, immediately it went right to skin color. Like when you read the article, like they really focused at one point heavily on skin color, though they talked about other things. So it really speaks to that psychological, that feeling of inadequacy that comes from not being quote unquote normal. That not having pigmentation, that inability to produce melanin. So I would definitely see I could see white people jumping on the opportunity, but it would not be to be significantly darker. I believe it would be more to look like they have a tan as if they sat out in the sun, rather than anything significantly dark that might get them shot on the wrong evening out with friends or something like that.
Absolutely. I would encourage folks to check it out. I think it's Huffington Post, if memory serves. I think it was at the Huffington Post. Where they published that, to kind of check it out and think. I remember when I asked Dr. Welsing the last time that I spoke with her, and I chuckled when I saw the handout from the last Welsing Institute. She included that article in the handout. I think it's Jennifer Doudna. I think that's her name, this white woman.
I believe you're right. I think it's D-O-U-D was her last name, something like that. It's like right. A weird spelling, but I think it's correct, yeah.
Absolutely. She included that article in the handout at the last Welsing Institute lecture, and it came up like in the third hour of the discussion. I think it was one of the folks that was in attendance. He asked her a question, and it had something to do with science and different things race are doing. Somebody just, man, technology. Someone just sent me a message on, I guess if you have a Mac computer, they have a Messenger service, so people can just drop you messages whenever they want to. And I hadn't been using this feature, and so it happened, I think, a week ago, and I had my headphones on, so it was really, really amplified. I had no idea what this was. I was like, what is going on? Am I under attack? Like, it really, it spooked me for a while, and then I figured out, like, oh, okay, that's what it is. I'm still adjusting to the noise, the little bell. I might even have to turn it off because it's still something I'm getting acclimated to. But whites and their technology, wow. But, yeah, she put it in that in her last handout. It came up in the audio. If you go back and listen to the last lecture that Dr. Welsing did at the Kress Welsing Institute. And when I was speaking with her on the phone, she asked me, I was reading the report to her because it had come up again. Whites have been talking about this a lot over the last, I don't know, 12, 18 months or so. It's in the newspapers and different places. They've done podcasts. I think I played a podcast more recently where they were, I was a white scientist, and he was talking about the implications of all of this. And he referenced the movie Gattaca. I don't know if people saw it. I think Ethan Hawke is in it, Uma Thurman, some other pretty well-known white actors with this white guy. He wants to be Ethan Hawke. He wants to be in the space program. And they have this material where you can very sophisticated science where you can alter genetically newborn children while they're still in the womb. I shouldn't say newborns, but you can alter the genetic material of a fetus. You can change the hair color, the eye color. If you see any genetic defects, you can change that before the child is born. If you want to make them super fast, super strong, super small, whatever, just let your mind run wild. And I thought it was interesting because in this film, Gattaca, the doctor that's talking to the parents in this film, the parents, they end up having multiple children. So one of the children, they alter his DNA so he can be super smart, super fast, you know, the best of the best, the Uberman. The other one, they say, well, let's just do natural. And the doctor is a black male. He's like, what? Natural? Oh, you don't want to do that? Anything can happen. And I thought that was really subtle because it was almost suggesting, like, you don't want to have mess around and have, you know, some dark, niggerish-looking child. You know, let's make sure we take care of any perceived defects before this child is born. Anyway, the child that does not get the genetic altering, he ends up doing all this just absurd stuff so that he can be an astronaut and go off into space. But the white guy, when he was talking about CRISPR in relation to Gattaca, he said that he thought that they drastically minimized how this technology would impact the world that we live in. Because he said, you already have inequality. They didn't say racism, white supremacy. They just used the word inequality. But he said, so certainly everyone wouldn't have access to this technology. He said, I mean, we're talking about like inequality on a whole nother scale. He says, I don't think people have contemplated you could genetically alter someone's material, genetic material, so that they have an easier time interfacing with computer technology. With how technological everything is becoming, I don't think people have thought about what the ramifications of that would be if you start having people that are born who have all of these features and what have you to make it so much easier so that they can be so much stronger and smarter and just have a much easier time existing on the planet, like what those ramifications are when you have people that don't even have access to basic health care. And then you've got, again, the Ubermensch, to use Nietzsche's concept. Now you've got that. Like, I don't think people have thought about how drastically this could alter what he called inequality, what I would say is the system of white supremacy. I'm also tempted, or not tempted, but also I remember 909 had said that he thought a lot of this could be deception. Racist whites, they lie a lot. He thought that there could be a lot of deception with this, and in terms of capabilities, what's possible, what's not possible with all of this, that they could be lying. That should be thought of as well. But I would say, man, and with whites, even if it's all the things that they were talking about and Roz suggested from the report, just that they could be looking to get this sort of technology if they don't already have it, gives you an idea. I think when Dr. Kanbaum, when he says racist, their capacity for evil is not in their past, Ben Tillman, it is in their future. I will stop there.
I was going to say, recently I thought they actually had genetically altered a chicken to have a dinosaur leg. I heard something about that recently. So if that's what they're doing, to me, that's a great sign of them actually attempting to do really Frankensteinian things, for lack of a better term. But they're capable of anything and everything, pretty much, I would say. Don't put anything past them. I think Dr. Tambon is abundantly correct.
Absolutely. If nothing else, it gives you a clue into that note, Yorugu, Dr. Marimba Ani, when she talks about the racist scientist. This is the mind. This is the worldview. The Utumwozo, I think the term that she uses, Utumwozo, in terms of what they would like to do. This is what they're thinking about. And a lot of times your thoughts, that ends up being prefaced to action and capabilities. So impetus for us to try to learn as much as possible to get this problem solved, because that's what they're thinking about doing. And with anything, go back to Mr. Fuller, any and all technology, any and all knowledge, grain of sand, will be used to strengthen, maintain white domination over non-white people. So where you should think about the context for all of that. We miss anyone? Any other folks have thoughts they wanted to share about anything? Again, our guest reneged, Vernon Burton, suspected race soldier in South Carolina, reneged on visiting with us this evening. Any other thoughts folks wanted to share? There were a few passages that he even included in his book that touched on white people and the impact of non-white people having sexual intercourse with white people and the impact on the offspring, because it came up a few weeks ago about, does it matter? Is it significant if we're talking about a victim of racism and this victim of racism happens to have a white parent? Is that significant? And I would say absolutely, unequivocally, no hesitation, for sure. It is highly significant and something that I think about and I think is extremely relevant anytime that we're talking about this situation, or if you're talking to a non-white person who has a white parent, or they're sharing their views on racism, white supremacy. Absolutely, it is significant and something that should be thought about, in my opinion. And I do not think I'm incorrect on that. Did anybody have anything else that they wanted to touch on?
Yeah, you know, the last show you mentioned the planet. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
The last show you mentioned the Planet of the Apes, and you kind of read off the scene. I think that was from one of the older ones, and I think that the scene that brought that all home was the Mark Wahlberg one, when he got in the spaceship and he got away from the Planet of the Apes and he got to what looked like Washington D.C. and the spaceship lands and ironically, he's looking at the Statue of Lincoln, but it's a monkey, you know, and it's like, oh, shucks. And then the police come out with the but they're all gorillas, and it's like, you know, he went to the more modernized version of it, and it was just, to me, that brought that whole scene you mentioned home, you know, where this was the future, you know.
Yep, absolutely. I know we've had a lot of people talking about, because we've done a lot of programs on the Planet of the Apes over the years, very significant piece of cinema in the annals of white terrorism. But I know we've had people who talked about that film over the years, and they say they watch the film and they see the apes as white people and I guess the humans as black people. I would only ask with curiosity if you apply that to all of the films. I think I know at least with Escape from the Planet of the Apes, and I think quite a few others, I would have a very difficult time making that assessment. I know certainly there are other films, because there's so many. I think there are like 8 or 9. Another one on the way. Some of them that works easier than others. I'm not sure it applies across the whole spectrum of all the films, and particularly the film I mentioned was Escape from the Planet of the Apes. I'm just not aware of any point in history where black people drugged white people to get information in order to maintain domination over them. I'm not aware of any facet, anything even close to resembling that in the history of racism, white supremacy on this planet. Not that I know everything that's happened on this here planet, but I'm not aware of that at all. That I am very aware of that sort of thing happening where white people are doing that to black people. Very aware. History, present. J. Marion Sims, right now, Drugs as a Weapon Against Us, the book that we talked about Sunday. I'm very aware. But that was something that popped in my mind as well. The caller at 5640, did you have a comment you wanted to get in?
Yeah, I was looking at Mr. Burton's picture, and he looks mixed race to me. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts of that. Because when I look at him, he looks like he's someone that's passing. But when I first saw his picture, I thought he was mixed race.
I've seen a few photos of him. You know, hey, the first question I ask folks come on the program, racial classification. Let's get that out of the way so we don't have any confusion. The images that I've seen, to me, looks like a white person. Now, again, the lighting and what have you, that certainly can have an impact on what the person looks like. Some of the pictures that I'm looking at, it looks like there might be lower lighting. I guess it might depend on when you're seeing him, where you're seeing him, the age. Sometimes people can have a tan. He's in South Carolina, so they have a lot of sun. So, you know, he might look a little different in the summertime than he would in the wintertime. The photos I'm looking at, I suspect he is a white person, but that would have been question one, just to make sure that we get clarification about that. Is he a white person? And then we could have got additional clarification if he has, you know, a non-white parent or non-white grandparent or what have you. But the few photos that I'm seeing, he looks like I would suspect that this is a white person.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of my questions about 96 South Carolina, what it was settled by. That's why I was going to ask them. I could definitely see a lot of people from that area being classified as white, but being a little tawny.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
To an observation I had today, I thought about Mr. Fuller. When Paul Ryan made reference to the Godfather movie, when talking about Donald Trump's antics, and I said to myself, wow, that movie is really, just like Mr. Fuller said, a shining example in so many aspects of the system of white supremacy. And I just, you know, laughed to myself when I heard him say that. That's all I had.
Absolutely.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. Just wanted to let everybody know, in case you did not know, may not be interested, but I think it would be something interesting. Renthal James Simpson, there's another report coming out on him. This is in the form of a documentary now. And I think it's about 30-30. I could be wrong, but I think it's about 30-30. And what I think they're going to include it, because it's a lot. I mean, he's been in front of the camera ever since he was some like a junior at USC, and even doing commercials. So it seems it's going to be on this documentary. It's going to be pretty long, from my understanding. Don't ask me on when it's coming on, but I know it's supposed to be coming on within months. If anybody else has heard about it, you know, speak up as far as. But I heard about it. I think I don't know if it was on the computer or on TV. I think it was the computer that I saw it on to be stay tuned that it's going to be coming up, and because they've been basically concealing a lot of. Videos and whatnot on him, specifically because of, in my opinion, of him murdering, well, suspected of murdering anyway, of murdering two white people. And so a lot of this stuff is going to come out on television, I believe. It's going to come out on television within months. That's all I had to say.
I am familiar with that project. I know I posted it on the Cal's group page last week. I think I posted it on both of them. And yeah, ESPN is doing it. It's supposed to be 7.5 hours. I'm not familiar with ESPN ever doing a 7-hour documentary on anybody. Joe Montana, Babe Ruth, no white person. 7 hours, 7.5 to be, you know, exact. And they have the trailer up already. They had the trailer in the post that I shared from last week. And I have said for years now, ESPN, almost all of the documentaries that they do on different athletes, racism is in there some way, somehow. Sometimes that'll be the main feature of the documentary. And most of them, they have a lot of interesting information. And as you said, I think this one is supposed to be like his, you know, I mean, 7.5 hours, you could tell his whole life when that much, with that much time. I mean, this is like Roots. I can't even remember the last time that they've had a segment that is, you know, this long. That's supposed to be dealing with black people and racism since Roots, really, that, you know, we're supposed to sit and I would think this is going to come on for weeks. I don't know how they'll break it up in terms of time-wise, but this would seem like something that they're going to have on for at least a week or so. That we're all supposed to sit around and watch this whenever it comes out, much like with the People vs. O.J. Simpson that just wrapped up. Matter of fact, that's where I saw it. They were writing about the conclusion of that. And it was, oh, by the way, we got another one. Part two is about to come out with this 7.5-hour documentary. So I absolutely, I think that. And I would even say I suspect that is no coincidence. Just with everything that's happening, this is an election year, that they know the significance and how that impacts whites, them seeing that and the race card, how that was such an important case and still to this day, after all these years, decades, still gets whites so riled up. It's been more than 20 years and he's still in greater confinement and they still get riled up about this, in my view. I mean, you can link that nicely. It's almost I would say it is almost Willie Horton effect, where they had the commercials back in 1988, where they just kept showing George H.W. Bush, where they kept showing the commercial of Willie Horton, who is this black prisoner. They released him. He got out on some sort of furlough program, and he allegedly went and raped this white woman. And it was, oh, my gosh, we got all these Negro hooliganisms. This is terrible. He was losing the election at the time to Michael Dukakis, and they kept showing these commercials with this surly-looking black male, and he ended up winning. I would compare it very much to just continuing to plaster O.J. Simpson, O.J. Simpson, O.J. Simpson. Clinton was in office when all this went down. To just keep plastering that on the screen to further rile up racist white angst and have that be expressed at the polls, either in perhaps voting for Donald Trump, whichever candidate they think is the best elixir to Negro hooliganism, like Willie Horton, O.J. Simpson, just my thought. Other folks, are you all familiar with this, or anything else you wanted to get in?
Yeah, you know, what's unique about Mr. Simpson is most of his life has I don't know about most of his life, but a lot of his life has been in front of the camera, and racists have been able to manipulate his life, twist it whatever way that's to their best interest, to either say, okay, this is a nigga who basically it shows an example of what we expect y'all to be, and then they turn it around, you know, with the issues, the problems that he had. This is why you can't trust him, and he has no pushback on it, because he's in greater confinement for one thing, but I mean, He's for a long time, he's always been, at least in this part of the world, I don't know about globally, but in this part of the world, definitely, he's been very popular to white as well as non-white people, because for a long time he was, you know, everywhere on television, you know, jumping in. With a suit on in the airports, and had all the white ladies saying "Go OJ, go!" and to the advent that we all really speak about him about, with the advent of being suspected of murdering his quote unquote wife and another white male. I mean, it's been act of manipulation by the system of racist white supremacy for most of his life.
you know, most of his life. And, yeah, so it's something that I imagine, you know, a lot of people are still interested in. I'm going to watch it for historical purposes and just see the amount of footage on him that I've never seen before that I know that they have, that I know that they have. It'd be good for me in that way, I guess.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would. Those ESPN films, they tend to be very interesting. I know Thomas in New York had mentioned one about the Colorado football program that had a lot to do about racism, white supremacy. The one that they did on Randy Moss, lots of information on white supremacy. The one that they did about the University of Mississippi and the school being integrated. James Meredith, the legend in 1962, is phenomenal. I would encourage watching that two or three times. I mean, they just have tons that deal with it's almost all of them. You can just pick. They did one on Jimmy the Greek. You just go through and pick. They did one on Muhammad Ali. Just, you know, go through at will, and you'll see tons. The one Burton Ernie that deals with he's a basketball player, Bernard King, where he was at the University of Tennessee, and racism, white supremacy is a big part of his career. They didn't even have that many black basketball players at the University of Tennessee at the time. It's tons of them that deal with racism, white supremacy as the main subject. What I wanted to get in really quick, I think with O.J. Simpson, just one, I think for much of his time under racism, white supremacy, his time on this planet, certainly the time pre-trial, he was regarded as a good Negro, quote unquote, maybe even an Uncle Tom, unfortunately, by many victims of racism. I think that's significant just because that's another example that even the Uncle Toms are victims of racism, and white people deal with them too, which is why I say, hey, let's just stick with racism, white supremacy. They're victims and go from that, because even the quote-unquote Uncle Toms, it doesn't seem that or it seems to be the pattern is for racists, you can be used and then you can be easily discarded and you're still a nigger, and whites can show you better than I can tell you. That would be one. Two, there was a really significant report that also came out last week. Retired Congresswoman Diane Watson and British filmmaker present town hall meeting accusing FX of misleading the public with the People vs. O.J. Simpson TV series, which I'm not surprised about. I didn't watch this series because of this. I watched the one episode, which was about the Furman tapes. That was the one episode I watched, and that was really only because Thomas in New York emailed me that one was coming on, so I did see that one, which was the next-to-last episode in the series. But the article, it reads, retired Congresswoman and former U.S. Ambassador to Micronesia, Diane Watson, and award-winning British filmmaker Joshua Newton held a town hall meeting in South Central Los Angeles to discuss the O.J. Simpson trial and the inconsistencies between what really happened versus FX's portrayal in The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Watson, Newton, and a panel of experts addressed the meeting's 180 attendees about the public's misconceptions and presented evidence in support of Simpson's innocence, deeming he was in fact framed. The evidence presented included autopsy reports pointing to two killers, missing phone records alleged to conflict with Marsha Clark's timeline, and more provoked indignation in the audience at the town hall meeting. In addition, Newton presented two side-by-side images of O.J. Simpson's white Bronco parked outside Rockingham hours after the murders. One image was a still from FX's The People v. O.J. Simpson. The other was the actual photo shown in the real trial. The FX image shows the Bronco's front wheel sharply turned with its tire pressing into the curb, which was meant to paint the picture that Simpson came home in a hurry after committing the double murders, while the real photo shows the front wheel straight on the white line away from the curb. Each image paints a different story, said Ambassador Watson, and is merely one of countless misrepresentations made by the show. Referring to the actor playing Cochran, a longtime friend of Watson's, Watson adds the TV version comes across as undignified, unlikable, and obsessed with using the race card to secure an acquittal. But that's not how he was, and that's not what happened. The jury gave their verdict based on the evidence, nothing else. And if anyone wants to say differently, I suggest they read the actual trial transcripts. There has been a massive grave misrepresentation of the truth, but fortunately things are about to change and the truth is about to come out, says Ambassador Watson. After a two-year exhaustive investigation into the case of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, Joshua Newton has written a conspiracy thriller feature film titled The Framing of O.J. Simpson. The Framing of O.J. Simpson is in pre-production and will begin shooting this summer for release in 2017. I will stop there. Yet another film, more O.J. content to come that you can look forward to, but I will stop there. And I'm not surprised by this at all. As I said, I only saw one series or one episode from the series, and that was the exact impression that I got, that Johnny Cochran is presented as some sort of buffoon. He does not come across in the show, at least from what I saw, as an intelligent, competent trial lawyer. He just seems like some loud, crazy-talking black person. He is not a light, really none of the guy. I mean, he almost reminds me of just a slightly more verbally eloquent representation of O.J. Simpson at times from the episode that I saw. The only people that I sympathized with or felt like there was any humanity in their portrayal was Marsha Clark, Chris Darden, and the Goldman family. That was it. Everybody else, just to me, mostly came across in a very clownish, buffoonish manner, which is what I thought this whole thing was being created for.
Well, you know, they had the before the last show on Saturday, they had the marathon going on, and I was separating my laundry, and yeah, they were, in my opinion, they were making Johnny seem like he was just out for anything. And one in particular scene they showed was when he was when he came up with the theory of the Colombian necktie, that maybe she had ties to drugs. But then all of a sudden, you know, this whole idea came from some Harvard professor who was teaching a class on this case at the time, and he faxed it straight into the courtroom, and someone hands it to Johnny, and Johnny switches up his whole line. And I'm like, come on. I mean, I wish he was here to defend some of this stuff, because they try to make it seem like all the ideas that came up, the freedom that Johnny came with, were either race-related or they came from a white person. And also, in the brief, what I was able to see briefly, Shapiro is comes across in somewhat Kardashian, too, as they have a moral dilemma. You know, they're fighting with the fact that all the white people aren't talking to them in their community because they believe that they're, you know, and they kind of want to do the right thing. They want him to just say he did it, and, you know, conflict of interest totally. And you can tell Shapiro was still alive, so probably okay a lot of the content that came out about him. But what I wanted to say, and I'm glad you were, because I wasn't sure if you had got that email about the Furman, but when I went back and read his actual statements, unbelievable. I mean, he's... In the fact that, and I remember this from the trial, they only let like two or three of the comments he made stay in the case. I mean, he has whole statements where he's planting evidence on people, and here he's the person that found the so-called evidence to you know, of a killer, and you don't put none of that in there. You know, well, we're not going to say that he framed, you know, little Leroy down in the projects or whatever. You know, we're not going to put none of that there. Just, he said nigger here, he said nigger there. That's it. And it's just like, so in my opinion, it's no way that you could have a case where the cop is proven to be that racist, and he's the person making the case against you. I'm just surprised that they didn't go back and look at all his cases and let all those people go. Because how can you go by anything he said? And I'm gone.
That's the same logic that they're using right now in San Francisco and even some of the other departments where they've had it released that these enforcement officers, race soldiers, were making all these racist text messages and calling black people niggers and all this other stuff that they said, well, we got to look back. We might have to toss all these cases. That's the exact same logic that they're using right now. And from my understanding, in what Furman was saying in those tapes, it wasn't like he was saying that, oh, this is just an exclusive thing that I do. It seemed like he was suggesting that this was a widespread practice that many officers were doing. Well, I've heard Mr. Fuller, where he said before, like, hey, man, if we, you know, are really looking at this honestly, like, this might be a, hey, just let everybody go. Like, I mean, really, if that's what we got here, just let everybody go. And that's not even saying that all these people didn't commit a crime, but it is saying if we are supposed to have a correct, just trial process, that has clearly not happened. So you should just let all these people go.
I remember when that trial happened, and from what I understand, the chief of police at the time, was his last name was Gates, I believe, and that was the culture. So, you know, when Mark Furman got up there and, you know, did what he did and said what he said and, you know, spoke what he, you know, called, you know, talked about how he called people niggers and all the other atrocities, that was like a permeating culture in Los Angeles at the time. So when we listened to, all we had to do was listen to groups like the hip-hop movement at that time, N.W.A. and all of that. They were letting us know exactly what was going on. So, Mark Furman was very truthful. I'll mute my line.
Yeah, another thing they did, I hate to chime in again, but they blamed the black dude, Christopher Dorton, for the whole case being lost. She told him specifically after he had her go hang out in Oakland with his best buddies, and she's at the bar drinking with these black guys. Is she a cowbell? I wasn't sure. Or is it him? Either way, you could tell he's hopelessly in love with her, and, you know, she's these black dudes, it's like, you know, man, I don't believe he did it, and she, you know, pulls out the glasses, and she shows the whole case and her, from her perspective, and she tells him specifically, don't you tell him to try you on the glove, and they try to make it seem like F. Lee Bailey, the white judge, lawyer from O.J., conned him into making him say, let's let him try on the glove, but that didn't lose the case for them. They lost the case for them was that the cop that was the finder of all this stuff, he sat there and pled the Fifth Amendment. He didn't testify. That's Furman. If he would have testified and said, hey, listen, I found the glove, I climbed the gate, and his testimony was competent, they wouldn't have had any problem putting that case away. But his testimony was tainted, and he pled the Fifth.
Also, just kind of be mild, I didn't want this to become a whole referendum on O.J. Simpson, but I feel like it's no apologies. It's, you know, I suspect probably one of the most significant events of the last three decades with regards to racism, white supremacy issues. This is where the race card came from. I think that's where that whole term, people started using it and what have you, and they continue to crank out, you know, all this content about Mr. Simpson. But and it's the pattern where they will suggest or make it seem that whites are fearful of some sort of Negro unrest, that black people are going to riot and we're afraid. If we don't, you know, handle this correctly, if we don't do it, if we don't do this the right way, black people are going to riot. It seemed like that was heavily suggested in the film. And to me, that is just laughable, because I have seen and read about any number of non-white people, black people rioting in response to racism, white supremacy, what is called rioting. I have never seen where it made white people change up. Oh my gosh, the Negroes have rioted. Martin Luther King was killed and they riot. We better, you know, shape up and do right, man. We can't, oh my gosh, this is, no, it was, oh well, Negro unrest. It's on their side of time. It's on their side of town. Oh well, moving forward. Same thing happened in Harlem when they rioted in 1964. Young black child was shot and killed, just like what we've been seeing now. Riots went on for a week. Oh well, moving forward. 92, Rodney King. Same thing, moving forward. I've seen this for a long, 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 long time. In my view, there is no evidence at all that quote-unquote rioting, that really gets white people shook, where they feel they got to do right. You had better not act like you're going to come out and give the wrong verdict or whatever. We're going to shoot, we'll burn down, the CVS is going to be, never. Who cares? It's on your side. It just means that you are going to have a tough time shopping or getting things done, and it will give us pretext to just bring in more armed white goons to shoot, loot, kill, arrest, beat, whatever we want to do. That seems to be the pattern of how these things unfold. And the area that gets looted, burned, it will be an everlasting mark to what we call Negro hooliganism for the next 50 years, if we so choose, until we choose to kick out all the black people and then whites move in and take over the area. Then we'll clean up everything from the riot. But that tends to be the pattern. I think that's just another act of racism to make it seem like, oh, man, if we don't get this thing right, black people are going to riot, and what are we going to do? Oh, my. That is total hogwash. Folks, all done? Anything else they wanted to share?
Hey, Gus.
Yes, sir.
This weekend, I got dropped off the line, so I didn't get to do my workplace racism, but I could wait till this weekend. But it was really a good one.
It is your decision, sir.
Okay, you think I should do it now or should I wait?
Your decision,
sir. I'll go with whatever you suggest.
Your decision, sir.
Okay, I guess I'll just say it. Essentially, it was an observation. We had a meeting, and in the meeting, essentially it's a health insurance company, so in the meeting, something came up about transgender surgery. And what I found fascinating was the fact that per the insurance company, before they would cover any transgender surgery, you have to go to a psychiatrist and you have to be diagnosed with something called gender dysphoria. And when I looked it up, it said they classify it as a disorder, and they specifically state that it's not a mental illness, because I remember Dr. Umar Johnson coming on the show and talking about how, I think it was in 1970 or 1971, up until that time frame, that homosexuality was considered a mental illness. And then it was after that time when they made the decision to remove it from the mental illness list. And, of course, society, as far as just the propagation of disco music and just homosexual culture in general, kind of skyrocketed from that point forward up until now. So when I looked it up, they described it as a disorder, and they specifically wrote that it is not a mental illness. So I looked up the term disorder, and disorder basically means distress or anxiety that means that an organism or living being is not healthy. So it's basically like, I was looking at it as like the rhetorical ethics. They're basically saying it's a mental illness, but it's not a mental illness. Just in the descriptive terms of the way it was written. And I just found it interesting that they claim that it's not a mental illness, but you have to go to a psychiatrist and be diagnosed with something like that in order to have the surgery. And it's kind of like when I started to look at it, it was similar to, how they describe it, because homosexuality is when a person does not want to be the opposite sex, but they use their sexual organs with the same sex. Whereas with transsexuals, they look in the mirror and they see themselves as a female, even though if they are male, or they see themselves as a male if they are female. And to me, it's this a mental illness? It's just like if a bulimic person looks in the mirror, they see themselves as fat, even though they might be skin and bones, and they're going to vomit to kill themselves, you know, make themselves throw up. So essentially, there has to be a mental disconnect there for you to see something that's not actually what reality is. And then, so I just thought about it, and I said, well, I need to bring this up on the show, simply because I found it fascinating that they have to have a psychiatrist diagnose you with something that they claim is not a mental illness, but in its descriptiveness, it's described as essentially a mental illness. And that was my workplace racism observation.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. It, again, whites, the most powerful racists, they do the classifying. Today it's a mental illness. Tomorrow it's not a mental illness. Why? Because we said so. That's what you can do when you're in a position of power. But that is fascinating that they would even have that requirement. To me, even suggest that there is some form of psychosis or some form of a mental imbalance, requiring you to go and see some sort of mental health professional to get their diagnosis before you can move forward. That is fascinating. Again, even on that subject, I'm still going to get the comments in from the book in terms of non-white people and the damage of having a white parent. But The situation in North Carolina where they're talking about this allegedly anti-LGBT HB2 bill that was talking about the bathroom, when I looked at that a little bit closer, the problem that I saw with it was not the bathroom issue. From my understanding, they were talking about the bathroom restrictions mostly just came down to multi-stall bathrooms with more than one person. Multiple people would be going to the bathroom at the same time, that you have to use the bathroom that is in alignment with your gender classification, sex classification, excuse me, as it is stated on your birth certificate. And if you go through the process that, you know, Ross just talked about, and you have any sort of surgery or what have you, you have to get your birth certificate, your sexual classification on your birth certificate changed, then you can use a different bathroom. That was it. That was not the problem that I saw. The problem that I saw was that if you feel you have been wrongfully terminated, subject to any sort of discrimination on the job, and you have been unlawfully, unjustly excused from your job, you cannot sue in state court for that. Now, you can go to federal court and sue, but that, the way, at least from what I've seen, that is a bit more of a cumbersome process and might even be a bit more expensive. I thought that was much more significant than this brouhaha about the bathroom aspect, but I'm not sure that as many people have said as much about that. But I thought that was hugely significant because that could apply for a wide range of things, including racism, white supremacy. If you have been unjustly terminated from a job and now you cannot go to state court and sue about this, you can only go through federal court to get some sort of redress. If you think you've been wrongly terminated, that, I mean, is massively important. And they're just kind of restricting the outrage. Oh, man, you're not letting, you know, you're against LGBTQ people and won't let them use the bathroom and blah, 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 and all that. And that, another aspect of racism, white supremacy, and skillfully. And they have even been able to marshal in a lot of victims of racism and people who talk about racism to get them to talk about this and say that this is one and the same. This is synonymous with racism, white supremacy. And if you, you know, are against racism and think racism is a problem, then you should be in doing all that you can to work against anything that is anti-LGBT and supporting gay rights, which just another more sophisticated aspect of the confusion. With that, I assume folks are satisfied. I did see another hand. Female caller in Ohio, did you have a comment you wanted to get in, ma'am?
Okay, thank you. Hello to you guys and to the callers and everybody. Thank you for taking my call because you made a statement. The first I was going to say that your last statement, I just wanted to chime in, was that personally myself, I think that law, and I have, you know, heard about that, and I personally myself state that law because I saw that too, the bathroom, but it was the discrimination, not being able to sue, you know. I mean, they've just taken that from the people, and I said, this law to me, it's for black people. I just think that you put it out here with this bathroom thing, and I mean, we're getting ready to get a new president. I don't care who it is, I don't care, Trump, Casey, whoever it is, Hillary or what. You know, it's just really going to be rough for us as black people. And I just feel that they highlight the LGBT, the gay stuff, to take it off, to make it like, oh, race doesn't have anything to do with it. And then, like you say, they send them out of black stuff. Oh, this is just like with black people, we got to fight this. And I think this stuff is for black people. I really, really do. I think in the long run, you will see that switch after this new president gets elected and gets settled into office. I just believe it. I didn't think that law, I don't know what the law is in Mississippi, but it's just Mississippi. I just think this stuff really is just a sly way to start getting cuffs back in at black people. That's just how I feel. And one other question, what happened to your guests, or did they show up?
I'm sorry, the guest, yes. What happened to Vernon Burton, the professor at Clemson University, he reneged on his agreement. We had confirmed earlier today. He had said earlier because they had an incident at Clemson where a banana was posted on a sign that was a banner, not a sign, for some of the African-American resources on the campus. And this got a lot of attention, and he had said that he might be called in to manage the situation. But he emailed after that and said that he was fine, that we could proceed with the program this evening. He gave me his contact information and then totally reneged. There was no follow-up, no indication of, you know, something came up and he couldn't participate, nothing. I called him I think three times up until about 30 minutes. The program was scheduled to be 8 p.m. Eastern. I called him three times up until I think about 8:30, and it went to his voicemail every time. I've been looking at my email the whole time. I never got a single email, nothing to explain his absence. So in my view, just tacky illustration of white supremacy and him reneging on his agreement.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. But I just wanted to, you know, make that comment about these laws, and I just truly think they're being slipped in by LGBT and, you know, people here, and I just really think that they're for black people. But that's me, you know, I might be, hey, you know, I may be wrong, and I hope that I am wrong, but that's just what I think. But anyway, thanks for taking my call. Have a great evening.
For sure.
Gus, just to piggyback off of what she said, last night in New York, in Long Island, there was a high school, I can't remember the name of the high school, but there was a meeting regarding that same issue, and they unanimously voted to have LGBT, transgender, whatever, children in that high school be able to use whatever bathroom that they wanted to use. So this is all about setting a precedent. So if they don't get you at the federal level, if it does, you know, they have precedent and local level. So I'm quite sure that didn't make headline news the way this issue in North Carolina did. But there are little pockets of this happening locally all around the country. And I think it's just about a legal maneuver to set a precedent so that when it does go federal, because I think this is going to go federal. This is going to be a national thing where they can go to any bathroom that they want to go to. This is definitely going to be a law and part of the whole movement. But they have to set these precedents and get it on paper. That's all I had. Mute my line.
Oh, I would agree. It is coming. That is the brave new world. It is absolutely going to just matter of time. I would say that legalization, all of that is coming. You can just put that on the calendar. It is a matter of time. All of that together, in my view, coordinated activities to spread mass confusion. It is not going to aid black people at all. And I think they've been really slick with both of these are being presented as fighting for gay rights, fighting for legalization. These things are working in concert against racism. And I take the exact opposite view. None of this is going to work out to the benefit of black people primarily, none of it. And I submit that all of this is going to strengthen the system of racism, white supremacy. It's just going to be mass confusion. In fact, I know here in Seattle, they had at the YMCA, that's why I said checking on a local level, it's embarrassing that I check like the New York Times, the Washington Post way more than I check the Seattle Times, because that's right here that has stuff that will literally be on my street that is dealing with racism, white supremacy. They had at the Y, right down the street, I could walk to it, the YMCA right down the street. They put this in effect. Okay, transgender, you use, you know, whatever bathroom, blah, blah, blah. That a white male, he went into the female bathroom, and females, they had the audacity to get uncomfortable to see this, you know, adult male going to the bathroom. He didn't identify as transgender. He didn't appear to have any sort of surgery or anything. And someone said they went to the people at the front desk and were like, you know, this guy is in the bathroom. Like, you know, what the heck? And they said, hey, this is the policy that we have. We're supporting this. They had about 300 cancellations in membership. The white people went out and protested. This is an outrage. We do not support this at all. We're not coming back here. This is not safe. You're putting our children in jeopardy. They flipped out. And I mean, they were talking about this for a while. This went on for weeks. And the Y said that they were going to re-evaluate the policy and what have you. And they said that they don't think that this is going to be the standard operating procedure where you'll just have somebody who is a grown adult male who just says, I'm going to the female bathroom while all the females are in there changing or vice versa. They don't think that that's going to be the case. And people being attacked, they don't think that that's going to happen. And they just want to respect everyone's right to be comfortable and to use whatever bathroom they want. But in my opinion, the white people, the reaction here, that is just following logic. That I do think that sort of thing is going to happen. The system of white supremacy, long aspect of it is sexual deviance, sexual perversion. That is a huge aspect of white culture. So in my view, of course you're going to have that sort of aspect. I even remember Mr. Fuller talking about They closed, they used to have bathrooms, I guess, out on the interstate if you were out driving or what have you, and they had bathrooms there, but they ended up having to do away with them because they had so much sexual perversion that was taking place in the bathrooms that they locked them up and had to close them down for a good bit of time. But just in my view, you're just going to have massive amounts of that. I wish Dr. Welsing was still with us to kind of get her perspective on that, but definitely something I would encourage folks to keep an eye on, and I do not. This legalization, I do not think either of these major forces that are getting all this attention is going to be a benefit to black people or help us get any closer to eliminating white supremacy. I could be in error. With that, I assume folks are satisfied, got in what they needed to. Right on. The commentary I was going to get in, one, passage in the book from our guest, suspected race soldier who reneged on us this evening, where he was just, in my view, this reveals truth about what it means to be white. You can insert what happened with Michael Brown Jr. Back in the summer of 2014, or any number of incidents that have happened with black people with this sort of disrespectful conduct. But he writes, during the mass violence of Reconstruction, whites left the bodies of murdered blacks where they fell, which enabled them to shoot at those who attempted to retrieve them. Whites were well aware of the terrible effect that their inability to bury the dead had on the African-American community. Matilda A. Evans, a black physician, who as a young girl attended school near Edgefield County, later wrote of one such incident. A group of men attempted to bury one of the bodies left on display. Because of white attacks, they had to put the murdered man in a pine box of cheap manufacture just as the unhappy man had fallen, without a funeral robe or garment, in everyday old working clothes. Very important, as I said, reminds me a lot of things that happened right today. Even Walter Scott, who was handcuffed after he was shot and killed in South Carolina, handcuffed on video, in my view, more of the same. Okay, non-white people, white parent. We had talked about that before. I do not have really any ambiguity about that. It is hugely important, the impact that it has for any victims of racism who have a white parent. We've done tons of programs on this, and I mean, we've hit this from all different angles. Non-white people, non-white, non-black people who have adopted white parents, black people who have adopted white parents, non-white people who have a white parent, males and females, all different angles, all over the years. You can go back to the archives. We've mentioned some of the specific programs. I think Thomas in New York, you mentioned Joyner Lucas. He was on the program 2014. Lacey Schwartz, she was on the program 2014. Tons of these. Dr. Darren Scott, he was on the program. He's been on multiple times. Black male who was married to a white woman. They had offspring. He talked about how his former white wife practiced racism against him, restricting access to his children, non-white children, and keeping them in an environment where they're exclusively around white people. Even one incident that I did not share on the program, and I'm just done with it because I was not, there were no caveats when this information was shared. Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., Cowbell, he's been on the program multiple times, the alleged founder of the White Privilege Conference, black male, married to a white woman, they have children. He told me this, and as I said, there was no, I'm telling you this, but don't tell anybody. He knew I had a radio program, public access, and I just didn't share because I was trying to be nice about things and not, you know, get really down, out, drag, personal about things. But there's really no reason to not share. It's true. And as I said, he didn't put any restrictions on telling me this information. And he told me this the second time I'd ever seen him, which I also thought was interesting. At any rate, he said, Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., the first time he was supposed to be on our program was May 2009. He also reneged. We ended up getting Mr. Fuller on just drop of a dime to take his spot. This is May 2009. When I touched base with Dr. Moore a few days after he reneged, and I told him the same thing, I value my time and energy. I put time into preparing for our programs. I was not pleased with him at all, and I told him so. And he was like, man, I apologize. I'm sorry. Allow me to make it up to you. I'm sorry. And he explained what happened as to why he missed our program, because he also, there was no indication. We had confirmed via the phone he was going to be on the program, time, the whole nine, and then nothing, no message, no nothing. And he said that he and his son, he has a son at the time, 2009, he was 15 now, I guess he would be in his early 20s, but he had a son with a white woman. The white woman kept his son for the first, I guess, 15 years of his son's life. And kept him in an environment that was pretty much exclusively around white people. He didn't have contact with other black people at that time. He said, hey, I want, you know, custody of my child. I want him to come and stay with me when he's 15. Come up here to Washington and stay with me. So his 15-year-old son comes up here. And they were having problems, conflict. And he said, direct quote, that his non-white child, and Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., is a melanin-rich black male. If you need a vision, he is about the complexion of Don Cheadle, right? Hotel Rwanda, people know who Don Cheadle is, okay? So his son is significantly lighter, has a white mom. He said his son did not see himself as a black male and even, you know, seems like there could be some difficulties in terms of his son relating to other black people because he hasn't spent a lot of time around black people. He's been with his white mom and her, you know, predominant white enclave, and that they, you know, had pretty significant conflict. And eventually his son, you know, he said he had sent him back with his mom. They weren't even there anymore. And it seemed like they did not have the best quality relationship, which no victims of racism have high quality relationship. But just that illustration right there, to have that sort of thing happen, and I mean, that is pain. When he told it to me, it was pain. If you can imagine being a father and having, you know, a just horrendous relationship with your son because of the white mother practicing racism, it was from a place of pain. And I have seen that play out. This is not even just random Gus ramblings. There is research on this. We had another guest on the program, Minka Makalanai, a professor. He was at Rutgers at the time. He also, non-white male with a white parent, he was on the program, and that's a lot of his research. Not all. He studies other aspects of racism, but he has studied this as well. And this is the pattern. When you have black people in some sort of sexual arrangement with a white person, invariably, particularly if we're talking black male, white woman, the white woman ends up with custody of the child. They end up being in an environment frequently where they are not in contact with other black people, and they end up having many more ideas about racism, white supremacy, about white people that are in line with their racist white mother's worldview. That's just the way that it comes out. And this is in a variety of ways, whether it's how they think about their black father, how they think about black people in general, how they think about themselves. This is well documented. You can just go back and listen to that program. He has papers written on this. He cites other people who have written about this. And I think France Wendance Twange, another scholar that we had on the program, black female. She did marry a white person, but they are divorced now. She did a book talking about this in the UK. White women predominantly in some sort of sexual arrangement with a black male. Same pattern plays out. Another program we did, Intermix. This is also UK. So you see the same pattern globally. We had a non-white female on. She had a white parent. Non-white parent. Same dynamics play out globally. But I say that these arrangements, tragic arrangements, the impact that they have on that child, it is astronomical. Even just if we stop from all of that, you're talking about a non-white person where 50% of their genetic makeup came from a racist. Just that alone is worthy of serious pause and reflection. Not to mention the socialization process that takes place, your formative years. You're in this white woman's womb. You're in a racist's womb for 9 months. And the impact that that has on your development, your understanding of what it means to be white, is astronomical and lifelong. Not to mention, you don't just have a white parent. You have white grandparents and white uncles and white aunts and white cousins and other white family members. That has an astronomical impact on your understanding of what it means to be white. In my view, that has to be debilitating for you to have an accurate assessment of what it means to be white. Am I saying that my mom is racist? Am I saying that my uncles, my grandparents, my aunts, am I indicting all of them? What does that mean about how I should relate to them? If I'm saying that my mom is racist, what does that mean about how I should think about the person who gave birth to me, who fed me, who taught me how to talk, who probably is responsible for me being alive? How am I supposed to think about that person? What is the constructive way for me to relate and function to my racist mother or racist father or racist grandmother, racist grandfather? You just go on down the line on that one. It has an astronomical impact. This is one of the few times that I will say, no, I don't have any doubts about this at all. I have seen this for years. We have done a lot of programs on this, a lot of study on this. I have seen this in observation. I have no doubt. In fact, I have never seen an exception to the rule. And I think we have even had non-white guests on the program who have a white parent who have admitted as such. How could it not impact my understanding of racism, white supremacy, and how I think this problem should be solved? We'll go to the text now, because part of this was sparked just by reading the information in Mr. Burton's book, who reneged on us today. So this is on in the book, page 187. He writes, the slave mistress had some influence over her owner and lover. This is a white man, insisted that his son take the word of his slave over his own opinion. These cases put new light on the oft-cited remark of Mary Boykin Chestnut in her celebrated Diary from Dixie. Like the patriarchs of old, our men live all in one house with their wives and their concubines, and the mulattoes one sees in every family partly resemble the white children. Any lady is ready to tell you who is the father of all the mulatto children in everybody's household but her own. Those, she seems to think, drop from the clouds. Benjamin E. Mays wrote of his wife's father and her maternal grandfather, both of whom had been fathered by slave masters, whites. The grandfather was very bitter toward his white father, but Mays's father-in-law spoke with affection about his white father. Let me back up and read that one more time. The grandfather was very bitter towards his white father, who should be thought of as a racist and a rapist. But Mays's father-in-law spoke with affection about his white father, racist, rapist. Mays's wife told him, my father did not hate his father. He adored him. When I asked my father one day how he could love his father, who left his property to Mercer University to educate white boys and left him nothing, my father cried. He said, daughter, you do not understand. My father was a good man. I was a slave in the system, and he was a slave to the system. Exhibit A. Moving forward. Next exhibit, because this pops up a lot in this text, as is generally the case, raping of black people, core element of racism, white supremacy. So next segment is on page, let's see. Okay, next page. This is on page 217, where he's in a segment, he's talking about the difference between free blacks, quote unquote, free blacks and slaves. The patterns of free blacks and mulattoes showed that the darker-hued free people were more likely to have intermarried with slaves than were the lighter-skinned ones, which I thought was significant, even though that's just one sentence, because he goes on in the book to talk also about how many of these offspring quote-unquote mulattoes, non-white people who had a white parent, that the pattern was that they tended to marry white people and that they tended to eventually be absorbed into the white classification, even if it took a generation or two. You would have these non-white people who had a white parent, they marry a white person, they have a child, that child can be classified as white, and there you go. That sort of process happening. He talks about this in the book and how that's another aspect of racism, white supremacy, which we talked about on the program previously. Minka Makalanai, he talked about that, how this further can continue racism, white supremacy, why I think it is highly significant when we're talking about a non-white person who has a white parent moving forward. This is on page 222. Might have to read quite a bit to give you. Oh yeah, I'll read a nice chunk so that you get the full context. So this is actually, I'm going to back up and start on bottom of page 223. Reading is more important than watching television. So bottom of 223, this is in segment assimilation. The growing number of mixed families, he means non-white people, some sort of tragic arrangement with a white person. The growing number of mixed families contributed to the decline in the free black population from 1840 to 1860. The manuscript census returns show cases of mixed families in which some children were classified as white and some as mulatto. Census enumerators seem to have declared the children white or mulatto on the basis of their physical features. This reinforces the notion that mulattoes passed as whites. In each census from 1840 to 1860, the greatest number of free blacks were under 20 years of age. Many of these children simply went over to the white community as they became older. Other free Afro-Americans left Edgefield for the North Charleston, Savannah, or Augusta. A number of light-skinned post-bellum free blacks, including relatives of John Hope from Augusta, moved north and west and passed as white. On the eve of the Civil War, the barriers between whites and free blacks were not as formidable as many have thought. Many Edgefield District free blacks were classified lighter with time. Men and women recorded as black in 1850 were noted as mulatto in 1860. For example, Fannie Smith, the wealthiest free black landowner in 1850, and her entire household were recorded as black in 1850, but as mulatto in 1860. Benjamin and Martha Artis and all their children were black in 1850. Benjamin died before 1860, and in 1860 the children were classified as mulatto while Martha remained black. This process continued after the war. In 1860, the entire Quarles family claimed to be black, but in 1870 and 1880, most members of this large land-owning family claimed to be mulatto. No individual, however, changed classification over the years from mulatto to black. It appears that a black in 1850 had to be quite light to be considered a mulatto, less so in 1860 and even less so after the Civil War. As Edgefield moved toward the Civil War, it appears light skin carried an increased premium. During this period, the pro-slavery case depended more and more on racial and anti-black arguments. The acceptance of free blacks and their survival in the white-dominated society depended on emphasizing whiteness, no matter how slight. I will stop there. Very, very important, particularly as much as we talk about colorism and the problems associated with that. It certainly has significance. A non-white person with a white parent, where frequently these individuals do have less pigmentation, less melanin, and the ramifications of that in a system of white supremacy that I submit is very much a racial hierarchy, where the darker you are, the worse you're treated. The lighter you are, the better you're treated. I absolutely think it is extremely relevant if we're talking about a non-white person who has a white parent, as this report that I just read from the book suggest it's been my experience that white people, generally, they do take note. They tend to be extremely observant in the system of white supremacy. I would say obsessive. Nobody is more color conscious than racist man, racist woman, racist child, and paying attention to whom is white and racial classifications on the whole. It's been my experience that they pay a lot of attention. Ooh, this is one of our niggers, one of our coloreds that has a white parent. That is important to note. That's, in my view, why you have the whole classification of mulatto, mixed race, dual heritage, whatever other terms, biracial, that they cook up and dump on us as we go. That's why you have these terms that they note. This is significant, and we want to make sure that we're aware of that. Oh, okay, this is a victim. This is a colored that has a white parent that has some significance to us and how we're going to use this victim and how we're going to operate our system. Racists take note of that. In my view, non-white people, we should make a note of why that is significant and how that's used in the system of racism, white supremacy, generally used to our disadvantage. Again, I typically would normally end my assessment when I make a suggestion or give my view on something by saying I could be in error. I will not do that this time because I have no doubts. I have no uncertainty at all around this. I'm very sure this is what it is. I'm very sure I am not in error. This is accurate. One of the very few times I will say that on the program. With that, if folks are interested in checking this out, I can't really recommend this book. Even if our guest had been present, I still would say the same thing. This is not a book I would. So, yeah, you need to check this out. It's got a lot of constructive information. Not so much. It's, you know, if you are interested in learning about South Carolina, maybe. If you have relatives, if you're born in South Carolina, then I would say, okay, maybe you should check it out. If you're so interested, I might be able to hook you up if you are interested in reading. But if you don't have any special attachments to South Carolina or just any zest for reading, you're just into reading about racism, white supremacy, and you want to check this book out, this is not one that I would recommend that you need to check out for any reason at all. That said, we should be here on Thursday, Attempted Counter-Racist Parenting. We've done programs on this many times before, actually, but I definitely think it's important and something that we should be focusing time and energy on, as we do have a good number of attempted black parents who I'm sure would appreciate being able to hear how the folks are doing with all this, problems, triumphs, suggestions, sharing information. I think super important endeavor, another area of people activity that we need to make sure that we are developing our counter-racist code. But that should be Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern. We should have counter-racist parents, attempted counter-racist parents, sharing some of their experiences and how racism has impacted the way that they relate to their offspring. Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We should be here Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Global Sunday Talk on Racism, Sunday morning, early time, 12 noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. Tune in. Looking forward to hearing discourse from victims around the world. If you have problems, gripes, suggestions, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Gripes, suggestions, complaints, other feedback that you'd like to share, feel free. With that, for the folks, if you were looking forward, I am always looking forward when we can talk to whites. Sorry, Mr. Burton did not appear. I'm even more sorry because I had invested my time to be prepared for him to be here, and then he reneged in his commitment. But that, too, to be expected in the system of racism, white supremacy. We'll be back. Should be 48 hours. I will again encourage, in light of our program on Sunday, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. In my view, I mean, really, that's one thing we can do with economics. We're not going to spend a nickel on any narcotics, poisons that whites have to offer us, legal or no. We are not going to spend any money. We have seen how that is used in a variety of ways to maintain the system of white terrorism. If you're going to be behind the wheel, you do not want to be under the influence. You're just making race soldiers' job much, much easier. When it's Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson coming to pull your vehicle over, man, you want to be clear thinking so you can make the best decisions of your life to keep yourself as safe as possible and any people that you might be with, any non-white people that you might be responsible for. Certainly buckle up if you're going to be out and about in a vehicle. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner of the blog. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email. We will get you a physical mailing address if you would like to support the program. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested and kept us on the air 7+ years. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.